Good morning, everybody. Can you see me?
Yes.
All right. Now, let me explain. I have a feeling that this year is going to go into extra innings. I don't know, there's so much that has come up, all sorts of stuff on the... Let me just start talking, and there will be a number of stories or events that will lead up to the shiur. The shiur was born as a result of an email that I received about 2 weeks ago from a fellow by the name of Avi Schwat, who wrote an article, and a Torah article. And the Torah article, he sent it to me because he said that he once saw something that I wrote, and he was commenting on that. So I'll tell you all about that. That's going to be the body of the shiur. But before we get into that, something that may seem like not terribly important, but I think it's very important. And if you'll start with the back page, just turn over. And of all things, Roz brought this magazine that we talked about last week. She brought it this morning, and the top paragraph comes from this magazine. The top paragraph comes from this magazine. Okay? Here it is. The article is How the Six-Day War Was Really Won, and that was the one that we talked about last week, that Roz responded. Of course, it leaves the impression that it was Tefillah and Torah, and therefore we talked about last week was that Tefillah and Torah are absolutely useless if you don't have an army. You can't ask the Rebbeinu to do miracles for you. You need an army, well-trained, strong. Okay. But here they have twice this opening paragraph, the great opening paragraph, and it's repeated again up here, and it reads the following. The Israeli Yom HaAtzmaut celebrations for 1967 were a grand show of military might. They displayed, there it is, the Avera that we said last week is worse than idolatry, adultery, and murder. Kochi v'otzem yadi. The Israeli army is marching, and they're showing their strength, and my strength, and the might of my hand. That very same day, May 15th, 1967, Israel's enemies started amassing against her, intent on killing every last Jew in Eretz Yisrael. What does that mean? What is she saying? Varda Litman, is she saying that's the punishment for Kochi v'otzem yadi? If you walk, strut around, showing my strength and my might, which in a sense means, of course, that we reject the idea of God. Is that what she's saying? Am I reading it correctly, or am I reading it like a nutty Zionist? No. She's saying one follows the other. Because they're strutting around, and they're making this great display of my strength and my might, the religion shows them that day, they moved into Sinai, which was, the beginning of the Six-Day War. By the way, if this is the way that Rabbeinu Shalom punishes us all the time, not bad, you understand. I mean, what was the punishment? That we got another half of Eretz Yisrael, you understand? And we crushed our enemies completely. So I don't really get the mindset. But for her, obviously, it's, I'll show you. So, you know, there's something I felt very uncomfortable about over here. So I'm becoming... I'm becoming more and more savvy. It'll take me many years till I can write on Facebook, which I don't even know what it means. Basis for Facebook. But here, I Googled, and you know what I found? I found that the Egyptians started massing their forces the day before. The day before. And there it is, I have the, below that, I have the order of the day, the Egyptian order of the day. Egypt's statement on troop movements into Sinai the 15th of May. On the 14th of May, 1967, Egypt, citing its defense pact with Syria, began to move forces to the Sinai Peninsula. Many of the troops passed through Cairo on their way east. A day later, a general state of emergency was declared in Egypt. No, but wait, so that means there's something a little bit wrong with the events as they appear in this response to the ugliness of a military parade, the ugly Kohi Viotsikadi. So it would, there's supposed to be some kind of a divine response. A divine response is that the enemy masses. The trouble is the enemy started massing the day before, which means that maybe everything is punkt verkehrt. And you know how I read the events? Watch how I read the events. The enemy started massing its forces on the 14th of May. On the 15th of May was Yom HaTzmaut and there was a military parade. I'm going to change my strength and the might of my hand only slightly. A capital M, my strength, and the might of my capital M hand. You know what the version is saying? You're massing your forces. My Tzadok is going to go in there and do the job. My might and my hand. Completely different tune. Isn't that a completely different way to look at it? But there is a mindset. There is a mindset where everything is looked at negatively. And it's been going on for a long time until today. One of my classic examples, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to take a few minutes of your time with one of my great examples. Was it October or November 11th, 1989? Now I'm going to tell you the facts, just listen to them carefully. It was a Wednesday. A Syrian pilot flew a MiG-23 into Israel and landed safely at Megiddo. Okay? We saw it in the paper on Thursday. I was talking to my son, Yumi, and I said, you know what? Those years, there were a period of years at which every Friday I bought the Yateid Ne'eman newspaper. The Hebrew Yateid Ne'eman. Negative. Everything in this country is bad. And it goes from better to worser. So here it is. It's Thursday night. So I tell my son, watch. Tomorrow, the Friday edition is going to have an editorial. And you know what the editorial is going to say? The vaunted strength of the Israeli Air Force. Where were all their warning systems? Where was their radar? Our Meshugana Syrian pilot is able to fly his MiG-23 into the heart of Israel and land in Megiddo. The Air Force isn't worth a plug nickel. Friday morning, do I have to tell you? Where are their systems? How did this guy get in? A shikach, a Syrian pilot makes his way in. This is our army. I could have written the editorial myself. Just as in the 10 years that I read the Haaretz, I could write the Haaretz editorials too. I mastered them all. But then I told my son, and I told it this in Thursday night before that, I said, you know what's going to become clear by Sunday or Monday? That this plane is going to be a bonanza for Israel and the United States. It was the most advanced MiG in the world at the time, and neither Israel nor America knew how it works. So they had no way of fighting it. Then I went on to tell my son exactly what did indeed happen. By the way, by Monday morning, and I have the New York Times editorial articles about the Great Bonanza, they had a MiG-23. America was simply overjoyed. So I told him, I said, you know how it worked? I'll tell you how it worked. On Wednesday, there was an emergency meeting in heaven. The Malachi came to the Rebbeinu and said, Rebbeinu, Uncle Yisrael, your people of Israel are in dire straits. Syria has the most advanced MiG in the world. They don't know how to fight it. Rebbeinu, you have to do something about this, and you have to do it very quickly. Rebbeinu gives instructions. That Meshuggah, the pilot, he's gone. But I want you to know one thing. We are silencing all the radar. Knock out all Israel's radar for those few minutes that he needs to cross the border and land at Megiddo. Malachim go to work, radar down. Pilot in. Okay? Rebbeinu says, put the radar back on. Radar back on. I'm certain that the way I see the events is exactly what happened. The Rebbeinu has been our pilot or our co-pilot for 65 years. He worries for Am Yisrael. So there are two ways to look at it, you see? There's one that can look at everything negatively, and then there are others who can look at it in a positive fashion. Just like our dear Varda Litman over here. Oh, that very same day, May 15th, 1967, Israel's enemies started massing against her. You know what? I'll say it the way it should be said. She's lying. And lies are used. It just didn't work that way. They started moving in their forces the day before. You cannot make a relationship between Israel's army marching. Tell you more. Rabbi Yisrael Gusman, the Tzad of the Roshiva in Rechavia.
Netzach Yisrael.
Huh? Netzach Yisrael. Netzach Yisrael. Rabbi Yisrael Gusman, who was a member of the Besdin Rav Chaim Ozer Gozensky in Vilna, the youngest member of his Besdin. I had the most unusual 4 hours in my life. I once was taking a train from Baltimore to New York, and I see this Jew, and I said, Shalom Aleichem. Turns out it's Rav Guzman. I stood next to him for 4 hours, and I listened to him. I should have written it all down as soon as I got off the train. But I didn't. He used to go out to the parade. He wanted to see the parade. He lost a son, Mayavel, in Vilna. The Germans grabbed the child. Never saw him again. There's the famous story of Guzman. Yisrael Oman, the Professor Oman, who's the Nobel Prize winner, had a son who was killed in the first Lebanon War. And he davened by Rav Guzman. Rav Guzman was at the Levaya when he came into the house of Shiva, a 21-year-old boy, killed in battle. So Rav Guzman said, I envy you. My Mayavel was taken away by the Germans, and who knows what they did to them or how he killed them. And your son fought and fell in the defense of his country, like years away. I have a friend who just told me 2-3 weeks ago he was learning in the Mir Yeshiva in the early 60s. Shaul Hyman. I'm going to say his name, what I'm afraid of. He'll get into trouble. He was learning the very yeshiva, and one morning he comes to the yeshiva, and nobody's there. Nobody's there. So he went to the place of Yudel Finkel, great chashiv of Mir at the time. It was sort of, there was some family relationship. So he says, what's happening? So he says, look, you know, it's Yom HaTzmaut. There's a parade today. Everybody has gone to the parade. Mir yeshiva, empty. And Rav Lezer Yudel told him, you know, you go too. It's good for you. Third story. By the way, I'm not just going to tell you stories. The stories that I'm telling you show different mindsets. And it's all rooted in a pasuk in Parshas Balak. That's where it's from. So we're going to get there. It'll take a little time. All right. We have patience. I had a Tayyarigid who davened in my shul in Harnov, Reb Shmuel Halper, a Galitziana Yid. He died a few years ago. He sat not far from me in shul. This was a Geshmaka Yid, like a Yid from the Alter Tzar. He went through the Gehenna of the Shoah, and he survived. And he survived. And he wrote, just a few years ago, he published his memoirs. A nice paperback, little book. I remember I came to one page, and even when I read it now again, simple story, but it's not so simple. It's after the war. He went back home, there's nothing at home. There's no place to go. He met up with a friend, and they're pushing wandering through Europe. There were about 300,000 to 750,000 Jews that were wandering through Europe with no place where to go. You know, all these fancy pants guys, you know, who needed the Medina, you understand? Who needed the Medina? Hundreds of thousands of Jews were homeless. Nobody wanted them. And then, of course, one of the great movements of populations in all history took place. Jews started walking literally across Europe to get to the Mediterranean shores. Maybe they'll get onto a boat someplace to Eretz Yisrael. And Eretz Yisrael, of course, is locked off because His Majesty's Navy is there with all of its might, Keichi V'yaitzim Yadi, of King and Queen of England, that are there making sure that no poor bedraggled Jew will ever make it to Eretz Yisrael. And Jews got onto those unseaworthy boats. So anyway, Reb Shmuel is wandering through Europe with a friend. Comes into a town in Italy. They make their way to Italy, Modena. And they're walking along the street, a house. They hear some sounds coming, all sorts of sounds, singing. They decide, let's go in and take a look what's happening over here. They go in and the sounds are coming from the second floor. He goes up to the second floor, the two of them go up to the second floor, and they see a soldier in uniform with a mug and David on his uniform. A Yiddish soldat, a Jewish soldier. They started crying. They had only known how to be beaten down. But a Yiddish soldat, they started speaking to him. It was a Sephardi boy. He was one of, you know, those miserable Zionists here in this rotten country. 30,000 of them enlisted in the British Army to be able to fight Hitler in Germany. The Jewish Brigade. They were in Italy. And here is a Yid. No, these Keichi V'yaitz and Yadinitz. These sinners who are ready to give their lives to Klal Yisrael. And he describes how he felt. 2,000 years, he never saw a Jewish soldier. I think that's a more correct way to look at it than all you hear about Sahal and all the filth and the ugliness that is said about it. And that's why it's all part of a shita, and we're going to get to that. We're going to get to it. Say a tefillah for Chayalei Tzahal? Nah. My mother told you a year ago, some extremely religious fellow from Manchester wrote an article that printed in the Jerusalem Post about why we cannot say the prayer for the state or the soldiers. Don't ask me to explain it because I didn't understand the word the man was talking about. But I remember that's when I wrote the ugliest letter I ever wrote, and they printed it. I said, you know what, tell them, we've been doing so well without your prayers for 65 years. Let's keep it that way. Okay, so here we are. We have English update. The Yom HaTzmaut March of 1967, and divine retribution comes immediately. The Egyptian army moves into Sinai. What retribution? What was going to happen was that these Sinai Yisrael were going to get a clap like they didn't have in their lives. And they're suffering even more. What they're suffering now, who knows what's going to remain of Egypt and Assyria. And now Jordan is finished. What's going on? The Rabbeinu is running the world. He's doing a pretty good job. I'm telling you, he's doing a good job. But you have to be able to see him. Okay. Rav Gusman and Rav Lezer Yudel Finkel are far greater authorities than others. And of course, remember we learned.
Panovich has a.
The flag, yeah, but the flag in Panovich was only, you know, it's the hotbed of anti-Medina, and with this flag over there. It'd be better if they take off the flag. They only do it lechvodo of Rav Kahaneman.
Right.
Rav Kahaneman was, I was in Panovich. These Jews, we're going to see what the approach of Gedolei Yisrael was 65 years ago and what has happened in the course of the past 65 years. But all right, that's the introductions. Those are the stories. But there's going to be one more story. This story is one that always moves me no end. And I start off by saying that somebody sent me an article that he had written. And he said in part the article was inspired by something he had read that I had written some years ago. It's a famous story. But I reread the story again. I do it every few years. Thank you. So, all right. So here it, the famous story is the story of Rav Herzog. And this story of Rav Herzog inspired this fellow to write this Torah article. What is the story of Rav Herzog? In 1942, Rav Herzog had journeyed to the United States on behalf of Jewish organizations in Eretz Yisrael. He also wanted to bring to the forefront the people who were not yet fully aware at the time of what was happening in Europe. Rav Herzog was an extremely impressive individual. He met with President Roosevelt, he met with a lot of people, spent a number of weeks here. And meanwhile, events were moving very quickly in North Africa. In North Africa, Rommel, the Desert Fox, had broken through the British and Canadian lines and was on his way to Eretz Israel. He's at El Alamein. From El Alamein to Alexandria was Egypt. Just Egypt, and the plan was to invade Eretz Yisrael. Mm-hmm. In Eretz Yisrael, they say that a third of the population were walking around with poison pills. There was a plan for the Jewish Agency, it had a plan to turn Har Carmel into a second Matsada for a last stand against the German forces. They all have to go down in battle, they're going to fight to the last man. The British, of course, are good friends. The British had already notified the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael that His Majesty's forces are falling back into Mesopotamia. And they're going to leave Eretz Yisrael completely open, unprotected, falling back into Mesopotamia. They even stopped permitting petrol for private use because they needed all of it for British army trucks in order to be able to evacuate the guys running away, the British. Okay, the stage is set. The stage is set. If Rommel breaks through at El Alamein, that's it. By the way, we will see. One of the sources that I quote is an article that was written some years later by Rav Dessler, of Elio Eliezer Dessler, who wrote that the ultimate plan was, and this is so fascinating, in the middle of 42, Hitler, Yimach Shemei, was moving on two fronts. Operation Barbarossa, going through Russia, Rommel, going through North Africa, and the plan was that the two armies would meet up, you know where? Eretz Yisrael. The German forces in Russia would come through Iran, Iraq, Syria. Rommel would come across North Africa. Eretz Yisrael would be caught with a vice and crushed. Rav Herzog is in the United States, and he tells the leaders of the Jewish community he wants to go back to Eretz Yisrael now. He must get back. Rommel had broken through Eretz Yisrael Sakona. They pleaded with him, you can't go back because U-boats held the Atlantic. There's no way to go. The only possible way was if a boat could get through from New York to Cape Town, and then from Africa, he would go from South Africa, he would make his way across Africa northward to Alexandria, and from there was a train that went to Rehovot. A group of the top Rabbanim of the United States, led by Rav Eliezer Silva, came to see Rav Herzog and his wife in their hotel room in New York. Rav Eliezer Silva comes walking in and says, "Ich paskin, we have paskin that the Chavavashi has no right to leave. You can't, it's Sakonis and Fushis, you can't go. Chances that you'll make it are not good." So Rav Herzog responded by saying, "I'm not living in America. You're not my paskin. Even on Eretz Yisrael, digger, I have my own paskin. And I paskin that I have to go back." Because he said he's not worried about the Sakonis Nefashis. They can be torpedoed in the Atlantic. But he says the Chil Hashem of a Rav HaRoshi of Eretz Yisrael at a moment of crisis, not to be with his people, there is no greater philosophy than that. I must go back. The committees that came to him, those who came to speak to the Rebbetzin, you can't go, you can't go. He said, I must go. And then finally he insisted, so they got him onto a boat, a passage on some liner, and the morning he's supposed to board, he gets a phone call that his no place for him, they can't have any place for him. He was distraught and he thought he suspected that his good friends, the Rabbanim around, are standing in the way. And then, it may have been then, was one of the times, maybe the first time, that he told to the Rabbanim, I'm going back because we have a Masorah, we have a Kabbalah, that there will only be two destructions in Eretz Yisrael. There will never be a third. There will never be a third Golos. So therefore, I believe with perfect faith, Rommel will not make it. To say that at a moment that Rommel, the great desert fox, you understand, was invincible, took great personal faith. Anyway, the story, I can't tell you all the details of the story. They finally got him on, they got him passage on another boat. The one, a few days after the boat that he couldn't go on, but they took him off, his secretary came in, threw a newspaper down onto the table. It was the Robin Moore had been sunk in the Atlantic. The boat he was supposed to go on went down in the Atlantic with all on board dead. And he insists he goes on the next boat. Next, the boat he goes on is the New York. How do you like that? And the New York makes it all the way down to Cape Town, and he arrives in South Africa. The heads of the Kiel are there waiting for him. And then begins an odyssey. It's unbelievable. I have to tell you the whole story. It'll take us on. How he makes it from one place in Africa to the next, from one place to the next. There were only two flights a week from South Africa to Cairo, and he wasn't able to, because all places were being used for military people. There were no place for civilians. And that had been the problem with the boats also. If a boat was going someplace, only military people. Anyway, Freglisch, a stop in Mozambique, something went wrong with the plane. A second plane is sent for them, and the second plane arrives Friday and is leaving Shabbos. And the whole plane is going, and the Rav says, I am not going on the plane on Shabbos. And everybody's upset. But they have to leave him, and he stayed with his wife. It was Mozambique. The heat was oppressive. They had no food. Some of the workers in the hotel brought them some fruit, the only thing that they could eat. Anyway, after the Chabbanish on Motzei Shabbos, a plane arrives, I don't know, from nowhere, and takes them to Khartoum. And they arrive in Khartoum. The people of the previous flight are there. They're all amazed. How did you make it? They got onto Cairo. They got onto the train. The train, and as they're going out of Alexandria, the Rebbe says, you know, let's close the windows. He says, no. I'll be able to smell the air of Eretz Yisrael. I'll tell you over there. They didn't close the windows. He knew, he felt really. They arrived in Eretz Yisrael. Comes to Rehovot, they had Mamesh, a big Kabbalah's poem. And at that Kabbalah's poem, there he said, they were amazed. He made this journey. It was a 3-4 week journey. It wasn't simple. It was an extremely difficult journey under the worst of conditions. And Rommel is still at the, he's still there. By the way, the day he arrives back in Eretz Yisrael is the 15th day of Tammuz. That's what? Sunday is going to be Tesvav Tammuz. Tesvav Tammuz, 1942, he returns. The real battle of El Alamein is going to start at the end of October. And then, of course, we know what's going to happen at El Alamein. The first defeat, as Churchill then said, until El Alamein, there was no victory, and from El Alamein on, there was never a defeat. By the way, they got stopped on both sides, in North Africa and in Stalingrad. The great plan of the two armies coming together and crushing Eretz Yisroel, it didn't happen. At that gathering in Rehovot on Tetvav Tammuz, Rav Herzog said, again, here he said it publicly, that there will not be a third Golos. Klal Yisroel, when they return for the third time, which is in our day, they simply, it isn't going to be anymore. And therefore, he said in Rehovot on that Tetvav Tammuz, Lo yofo tsar v'oyev, the enemy will not enter Eretz Yisroel. How do you say something like that? The mighty German forces are banging against the doors of Cairo. The great British army is preparing to flee. Herzog says, Lo yofo tsar v'oyev, the enemy is not going to make it into Eretz Yisroel. I feel a great schus that I got to know that man, a very big schus he was. All right. This fellow who wrote the Torah article, on what did Rav Herzog base his conclusion? Sources. Where are the sources? He went looking for the sources. And that's what we're going to talk about. And I'm beginning this search for the sources in Parashat Bullock. I didn't forget that this is a shir on Parashat HaShavuah. I know exactly what the parameters of my job here are. It begins in Parashat Bullock. That's where everything begins. And by the way, what we're going to learn over here is hashkafa of everything that's happened here in the last 100 years, and it makes a very big difference. You know the sources, it makes a big difference. And I'll tell you how. We started off with the two ways of looking, at it. The Israeli army marched on May 15th, 1967, and, Egyptian forces moving in, punishing those Kayhuyoitsigadinis, or taking a look at it as I look at it, my God's might and my hand. That's the way he looks at it. They're looking in different ways. There are those who believe with absolute perfect faith that this Medina, Chas v'Shalom, is going to come to an end. This Medina is destined to be wiped out. I have a 600-700 page sefer with thousands of proofs that the Medina is destined for absolute destruction. And then, of course, on the other side, we have a Rav Herzog who says there will never be another Purim. This is it. This is for keeps now. Two different hashkafas, which, of course, therefore, color everything you look at. Whatever you look at depends what goes on over here. If your head tells you one thing, then you look at everything negatively. If your head tells you something else, then you see things in a completely different light. The name of that sefer that I have was written by a Satmar Chusid, Derech Hatzolah, the way of salvation. And on the cover it says, flee from Eretz Yisroel now! Get out while the getting is good. We Jews, we're so funny about the way we look at things. Let's go. Don't anybody ever accuse me of not having learned Torah over here. Everything is Torah. Where's my source sheet? Oh, here it is. Yeah, I got it. Of all things, one of the most important ideas in Torah, we learn from something that was said by that one-eyed monster, Bilam. It's unbelievable. Here it is, Noam Bilam, Beno Bor, so says Bilam, the son of Bor, Noam Hagera, Sesum Hayin, and the words of the man with the pierced eye. Boy, was he able to see. Noam Shomea Imbeel, so says the one who hears the words of God, Vyodea, and knows God's mind. Wow. Deadas Elio. Machase Shaddai Yechese. He sees the visions of Shaddai. No fail. Ugluy Elaim. While fallen, but with eyes that are open. Ah, does this fellow Bilam see? And here is the pasuk. One pasuk is all that we have to learn. And Enu Veloato. I see him, but not now. Ashurenu. I view it, okay, Velokaro, but it's not close. What is it that he sees and not now? He views, but it's not close. Dorach Kolchov me Yaakov, a star shot out from Yaakov, become Shevet me Yisrael, and a rod, a ruler has arisen in Israel. Notice he sees the rise of the Jewish people. Umlochatz Parte Moav. And this star that's going to shoot out of Israel, and this great rod, is going to crush the enemies of Moab, the Karkar Kol B'nei Sheit, and undermine all the children of Sheit. So Rashi says, number two, at Enu, I see it, Ro Ani Shivko Shel Yaakov, I see Jacob's glory, U'gdulato and his greatness, Ach Lo Atohu, it's not now, Elo La'ach Hazman, it will be later. You know, I see things, but it's not right now. Not right now. Dorach Kochav, a star shot forth. This is to be understood, Targumo, as Targum Unplus renders it. Lishon Dorach Kashto, he released his bow. Shahar Kochav Over Kachetz. The star shoots out like an arrow. All right, Klomar. Yokum Mazal, a favorable sign will arise. The star that shoots from Yaakov is an indication that things are going to go well for Yaakov. The Kom Shevet, there will arise a rod. A rod represents a ruler. Melech Rode Umoshe, a king who is going to dominate and is going to rule. Okay, now from here we can go to the Orach Chaim HaKadosh. Now you will note that's number three, and you will notice, of course, that the yard site of the Orach Chaim HaKadosh is this Sunday. Isn't that interesting? Rav Herzog arrives back on the 15th of Tammuz in 1942. The yard site of the Orach Chaim is going to be this coming Sunday, and the Orach Chaim HaKadosh died in 1743 and is buried on Har HaZeisim. And there will be thousands of people who will go to his kever. It was Rav Chaim ben Atar. He came from Morocco. He was 47 years old when he died. But he is one of those who received the title Kadosh. There are a few. The Orach Chaim HaKadosh. You don't say Stam the Orach Chaim. The Holy Orach Chaim. The Holy Orach Chaim. So Sunday, but there also happens to be a Masorah from Baal Shem Tov that he died on the 14th of Tammuz, which would be Shabbos. So this Shabbos can't go anyway to the Kever. People will be going to the Kever of the Orach Chaim on Sunday. The Orach Chaim. Orach Chaim says the following. By the way, he had come, I said, from Morocco, persecuted, you know, sometimes they try to leave you with the impression that until the Zionist movement, Jews and Arabs lived for 1,000 years side by side in great friendship, you know, Ibrahim and Abraham and Isaac and Isaac, he had to flee from one place to the next until finally he came to Eretz Israel. And Enu Velo Ato, Kafal Hadvonim, the Milot Shonot. This is a repetition, right? Ashurenu, I see it, Velo Ato. And Enu Velo Korov, same thing, but it's repeated, different ways, right? Okay. And what's going to happen? The second part of the pasuk is also a repetition. Dorach Kochav mi Yaakov, a star shoots out of Yaakov, the Kom Shevet mi Yisrael, and a ruler comes over Israel. A second double. The third double is Umachatz Parte Moav. He will crush the ends of Moab, the Karkar Kol B'nei Sheit, and he is going to undermine all the children of Sheit. So he goes on to say, back to the Yerachayim, Gam Kocha Loma, he also repeated Dorach Kocha, and then the Kom Shevet. There are three parts to the Pasuk, and each part of the Pasuk is repeated. Ashuren v'lo ato, enu v'lo ato, ashuren v'lo kora, Dorach Kocha v'yakov, the Kom Shevet v'yisro, machatz pasi, ma, the karkar kol b'nei shek. So he goes on. Kol ha-nevuah v'melech ha-mashiach nemro. This entire prophecy of Bilam, he is from Bilam, is prophesying about Mashiach. And to understand this pasuk, it can only be understood on the basis of what our rabbi said in Sanhedrin. Sh'omru b'pasuk, they said on a pasuk in Yeshayahu, Be'ito achishena. Be'ito, in her time, achishena, I will hasten it. What's that? That's not an oxymoron. They contradict each other. It's an oxymoron.
Yeah.
Deafening silence. Deafening silence. Two words that contradict one another. Ito means it's time. Achishena means that it is hastened. Now, then, wait. If it's in its time, it's not hastened. If it's hastened, it's not in its time. How do you say these two words? How does Yeshayahu say these two words in one breath? So the Gemara explains. Zachu, if Israel is worthy of redemption, achishena, I will hasten it. Lo Zachu, but if they are unworthy, then it will be be'ito. It will come in its time. Mother, there is a time that redemption will come to the Jewish people, whether they are worthy or unworthy. Two possibilities. Be'ita achishena, therefore, be'ita means if we are unworthy, then it will come in its time, regardless of everything. If we are worthy, it will be hastened. So therefore, he says the following. If it's be'ita hu rachot muflag, if it comes in its time, that means it can be a long way off. From Bilam's day, is it going to be a long day off? V'zelechos, and here, Yerachayim says, take a look at this is the sign. Hein onu b'tchilas meyo hashishis le'elach hashishi. We are at the beginning of the 6th century of the 6,000. Meyo hashishis le'elach hashishi. In other words, he must have been someplace around Mea Chamishis is 5,000. We're 5,773. Okay, so he's 5,500. That's right, 5,500. And that means it's a pretty long time since Bilam. Been a long time. By the way, he's also he certainly is alluding to the many sources which. From which we see that the each 1,000 years of the world represents one day of creation. Yeah. Ultimately, what must come is the Yom HaShabbos, the great Shabbos, which represents redemption. Which means, in the cosmic order of things, you know where we are? We're right now at Erev Shabbos in the afternoon. The great Erev Shabbos. Because we're at 5,773. That means we're sometime about 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon. And by the time of the Shkia, of this great day, that's it. That's going to be the Geula. Boy, will things be happening around here. But it may come earlier. The process may be hastened. Understand? From the beginning, from 5,000, from the year 5001, that's the beginning of Erev Shabbos. That's Thursday night at 6 o'clock. 500 years later, you know where you are? 500 years later, you are already at 12 noon, right? We just got another few hours. It's coming close. All right, let's go. So therefore, Keneged Beis Kitzim Elu Dibrakosim. The pasuk is talking about these two possibilities, the two possibilities of the end of days. One is the quicker, and the other is the longer. And Enu, I've seen him, but v'lo atah, not right now, but not too far off. The second phrase of the pasuk, Ashurenu, Ashurenu already means something that I see off in the distance. And Enu is something I see before me. Ashurenu is something off in the distance. And Enu, I see it, v'lo atah, but not right now, but not too far off. Ashurenu, I view it, I see it, aspire it from the distance, but v'lo karob, it's not close. That's the second possibility. That Geula will come in its time. Bi'ita. And then, now becomes very important. Imzako, Ama, if we are worthy, it says, En enu perish l'dovet, min shani osit loma, avula inu ato, not right now, bizman zeh, el bizman acha, leidet, yocholiyo, chenu rocha kokafet, would be, that's not going to be far. Sh'on ruzal, im hoi yisrael, chayzim b'tshuva, chayzim b'tshuva, chayzim b'tshuva, chayzim as they should, they would be redeemed immediately. Even if only one day they would be in Golos. Because it says, we say it every day in Davening, Hashem, the Yom Tzor of God is going to answer you on the day of Tzor. One day. All you need to be in Golos is one day. You do tshuva, it's all over. But otherwise, it can be longer. But with regard to the second possibility that the end of time will come in its appointed time, Amar, he said, Ashurenu, I see it from the distance. Somebody looks from the distance. It's not close. But the end that comes as in the normal course of things. It could be a long time. The Omro, Darach Perish Zotri Hanadwash Amar Aleha and Enu. In other words, what is he talking about? What is this? What is it that he sees? So the next part of the pasuk says he sees a star shooting out of Yaakov, a ruler arising from Israel, the might of Israel. That's what Bilam, the one-eyed guy, sees with his one. But there's one fresh look at eye. And some people can have two eyes and still not see. The cable of Ingham, the Shimei Loshin, Yidbayer al Pidavrem. And here's where everything is, this is the source of everything. Shamru, our rabbi said, Shintia ha'lu'ula b'emtzot, Zuchut Yisrael, if the redemption is going to come through Israel's merit, Ye adoro mufla de malo the yit ala hagoe yisroel min ashamayim the mofet vil. If Israel's redemption will come as a result of the fact that they are worthy and they have earned it, then it's going to be something that's going to be miraculous. The whole world will sit up and take notice. It's going to be completely beyond nature. But if the Geula is the other possibility, that we're not worthy, but it comes as part of God's divine natural process, then it will be step by step, it will come within the folds of nature, within history, and if one doesn't look carefully, they can miss it. Watch. Masha'in came. Kishetiyah ha-Geula mitzad ha-Keitz, if the Geula, the redemption comes as a result of the predestined end. The aim is for Ruim Lo and Israel are not worthy. Tiyah ba'ofen acher will be in a completely different way. Vo'aleo nemar, and about that kind of redemption it says, Sha'goel yavo oni v'rochei ha-Chamor. Poor man riding on a donkey, step by step, or as Chazal described it, kimo, kimo, bit by bit. So these are the two possibilities. Two possibilities are that redemption will come in a great burst and shake the whole world, clear to all. Or it's going to come within the folds of history. But the truth is that even within the folds of history, which is what we are experiencing now, is pretty fascinating. It's very, 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 very fascinating. You understand? Very. So now, what happens if you believe that there's only one possibility of redemption, and redemption is only by a divine act? Then whatever is taking place over here is complete rebellion against God's plan. And we're all a bunch of sinners. And that this is going to have to come to a disastrous end. But what happens if you believe, no. There's a second possibility. The Rebbeinu may very well bring the redemption of his people step by step. It can take 100 years. It's already taken 100 years. I always say, we said it a few weeks ago, the movement that changed the whole world in the 20th century, nationalism. Nationalism changed the globe, changed the map. Empires came crumbling down. Britain, Great Britain, sun doesn't rise on it anymore. But all the great colonial powers, France, in there. Belgium and Holland also had the great empires. And what? Self-determination became the catchword. For what? For 100 or more countries that came into the world that are still locked in struggle, in poverty, in suffering? Or did the Revelation do all of this so that in a moment of great chesed, one country, one nation can come into being? It's obvious. For Sri Lanka, we needed all this, and for Chad and Zimbabwe. We needed the whole upheaval of the 20th century. For that we needed it. Of course we didn't need it for that. But so within the folds of history, if you look carefully, you'll see what it is. So this is what the Orach Chaim tells us. And therefore he says, the second part of the pasuk says, Dorach Kochav Yaakov, the star shoots, that's something that's so clearly divine. Or become Shaven be Israel. A ruler arises, come, represents something that is part of a process. With regard to the Gula, which is hastened, that is Ben Salut, Zuchut Yisrael, that comes because of Israel's worthiness, at NYC, Veloator. There he says, so you see, the Orkram is explaining. At Enu Volowata, what corresponds to it? Dorach Kochav Miyakov. At Enu Volowata, I see it, but it's not right now, but it's coming soon. That's going to be when Israel are worthy, and it's therefore a great act of God, so it's a star shooting out of the heavens. But what happens if it's part of the natural process of Ashurenu? I see it off into the future. It's not close. It's not close. Then you know what's going to happen? But come, shave it. Yisrael. It's going to arise. Gam Ramaz, the Kochav Ayotze, the Emsa Shemayim, the Nes Mufla, that is the star that shoots out of heaven, is an unbelievable miracle. Kamar the Sefer Azor, who keneged Gula B'Ita, corresponding to the Gula that comes in her time. She Ramaz, that he alluded to in the statement, Ashudanu Korav Amar, to come shave it Yisrael Perush. Shiyokum Shevet Echad Misrob Kederech Hakomim Ba'olam Bederech Hateva. The way nations arise in the natural order of things. Satmar rejects that completely. It can only be miraculous. The only one who has any right to make any kind of gula is God alone. Man has no right. And whatever man does in that respect is sinful. We're all just sinners over here. But there is another approach. And the Arachayim HaKodesh says, no. It can come as part of a natural process. Al derech omro, as the Neil says, Ushval anoshim yokum aleim. Shiobo oni, you know, it's going to become a poor man, rochev alachamor, riding on a donkey. I always say that the first stop in Yerushalayim, he's going to park his donkey in front of my shul in Har Nov, Davin Mincha, and then he's going to get on the donkey and make his way to the Kotel. Maybe to Rav Nachman's shul in the Muslim quarter on the way. I think so. Okay. Oni v'rochev alachamor, we should be there to see it. V'yokum v'yimlo v'yaseh ma'ashenema v'samach, and he's going to do what it says further on. The next few psukim are going to talk about the awesome things that Moshe is going to do. We're going to see, this is mamish, this is going into, definitely into added innings, no question about it, because we're going to have to learn the Rambam, where the Rambam says the belief in Mashiach, number 12 in the 13 articles of the faith. Here, this pasuk in Bilam is a fundamental place from which we learn it all. They're going to be fascinating things I'm going to learn. To be continued, now I say if Rabbi Adler is coming on Shabbos of the Tammuz, I'm coming. He's younger than me, and he's always been younger than me. And we're going to make it. I hope we do. Yes.
Don't we believe in a cold Shemayim?
Michael, you'll have to ask that question next week.
It's good to be back, Rabbi Goldberg.